Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. In roughly the 1970s, conventional Western medicine shifted its emphasis from treatment of acute situations to prevention of chronic illnesses. It started with research that categorized risk factors. Early members of Kaiser's Permanente HMO may recall the multiphasic exams, an entire afternoon of testing offered to family members of all ages. The information gathered by different institutions were studied and standards were set for results above which treatment would be encouraged. Since healthcare policy sought compliance from their patient population, the numbers were often lowered below what was shown to be normal. This shift from the treatment of acute symptoms to lifelong disease prevention was a boon for big pharma. No longer would medications be used only for short duration. Now patients would be using medicines for the rest of their lives. In this atmosphere, symptoms and risk factors have become diseases to treat. Might they also be seen as the body's own way of restoring balance? Join me and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett as we discuss risk factor medicine. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is a political economist, a writer, and a health strategies advisor who co-produces this program with me and is the backbone of our newsletter, The Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. In addition to the work he does with me, he also works with individuals making healthcare decisions, and you can reach him by going to our website or calling him directly at 707-874-1496. So we'll forego the editorial and we'll move right into our topic for today, which is risk factor medicine. And this new view of treatment translates a person's characteristics as categories of risk factors. So how does this differ from your understanding of prevention?
Well, the phrase risk factors appears first in the medical literature in 1961, and it comes from a publication from the Framingham Heart Study. Framingham Heart Study is the most famous, although not the only, of what are called prospective health studies around coronary heart disease and other diseases that ushered in this shift to risk factor medicine. What distinguished the Framingham, Massachusetts study was that they very self-consciously were proselytizing this new view of how to deal with disease. And that shift came about, started in the 1940s with a number of studies, including the Framingham study, which arose out of the observation of medical researchers of what's called the epidemiological transition, which means that at the beginning of the 20th century, people died mostly from infectious diseases. By the year 2000, or what they were seeing by mid-century, was that people were dying from chronic disease. Another conceptual, and so they wanted to understand what the relationship was between events, characteristics of people, and how those chronic diseases developed. Conceptually, another shift occurred from just the description of these diseases, which were called degenerative diseases because they were considered the product of aging. It was simply a matter of you got old, you had a heart attack. The shift to the use of the concept of chronic disease meant that it was now something which was treatable. And it was treatable by studying what the characteristics of individuals were. And characteristics originally could include a wide range of things. In addition to the physiological measures like cholesterol levels and blood pressure, they were looking at diet and income levels and smoking status and race and geography even. And so what this ushered in was a period of medicine where prevention of development of chronic diseases became the focal point of much of medical practice. What also happened was that pharmaceutical companies in the 70s saw the opportunity here, as you mentioned in the opening, that instead of developing drugs for specific acute conditions, they could get people on drug treatments for literally the rest of their lives. In order for that to be an effective medical practice, those risk factors needed to be translated into some kind of standard of care, so that now what we have is symptoms of perhaps disease processes being categorized as the cause of disease, being categorized as disease themselves based on whether you meet or exceed some test result. What counts as high blood pressure, what counts as high cholesterol.
Well, going back to what I was trying to ask you is you know, you've just framed kind of your argument about risk factor medicine, and I agree with you about this, but how does this differ from what you understand prevention of disease to mean?
There is really what I think is a seminal book on the subject published about 10 years ago by Jeffrey Rose, a little small book called The Strategy for Preventive Medicine, in which he argues that this strategy of risk factor medicine actually makes no sense from the standpoint of primary prevention, that a more sensible strategy would actually look at those risk factors as things that are occurring in populations of people, and to act through public policies to affect those risk factors, so that instead of having, first of all, prevention reduced to coming up with a diagnosis based on established standards, mm-hmm. that are simply about physiological and metabolic measurements, mm-hmm. that it takes into account the broader set of risk factors that epidemiologists were looking at.
Well, so what I was trying to get you to talk about is what your view of prevention is, and I guess a glimpse of that would be that you wrote an article where you talked about you were talking about cholesterol-lowering drugs and things that lower C-reactive protein, and you were saying, that you used the metaphor that it was like having the firemen come in and get rid of the smoke and leave the fire burning. So, what I'm trying to get you to say is what would be an appropriate, given what you understand or how you look at. Because it isn't, let's put it this way, I'll back it up. If somebody has shortness of breath and high blood pressure and their blood sugars are getting high, we aren't suggesting that because the standard of care in Western medicine says those are risk factors and we have to medicate you, that those risk factors should be ignored. In fact, those risk factors are still clues to what may be going on in the body.
Yes. So that the answer here is that as I skated over very quickly, the development of this treatment, this form of treatment, is that symptoms, which should be telling us diagnostically to figure out what's going on, mm-hmm. in someone's body, got turned into diseases themselves, mm-hmm. and in addition, this whole what the risk factor approach opened up, but which isn't being taken advantage of, is that there's really a lot of unraveling that needs to happen in order to understand how you get from a potentially disease-causing set of events, some metabolic disruption, some physiological disruption, to those symptoms.
So give us an example.
High blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of hue and cry about high blood pressure, and the standard, the conventional argument is that high blood pressure puts you, well, what's called essential hypertension, puts you at risk of coronary heart disease
and stroke.
However, if one just simply thinks about the mechanics of what's going on, high blood pressure comes about because of one of two things. The heart is pushing harder, but it's pushing harder either because the actual vessel is tightened or restricted, so the heart has to work harder to push that through, push the blood through, or the blood itself is more viscous and it's harder to push through. So where that takes us is, what is it that's restricting the blood vessel itself, or what's making the blood more viscous? And that leads to a whole other set of unraveling, so that, in fact, high blood pressure, many practitioners believe that high blood pressure doesn't cause arteriosclerosis. It is a consequence of arteriosclerosis. And so to elaborate on the answer to the question that you opened the show with, the real need here is to use those signs, those symptoms, those risk factors, as a way of unraveling what's actually going on in your body, and not as diseases themselves, which simply need to be hammered down into an appropriate range.
It seems though that So what you're saying is that you're saying that there's, the way I usually describe it to people is that there's a cascade of events that causes something to happen, that nothing just happens in an isolated way. So you're talking about something is causing the blood to be more viscous, or it's causing there to be less elasticity. Another cause I found for hypertension is that when people start to measure their blood pressure, what they'll find is that it's very emotional.
Yes,
it's very much.
That's absolutely right.
And my experience is with seeing people is that somebody will come in and they have hypertension. The doctors want to medicate them. And when I start to do a health history, when I start to talk to the person, what I discover is that they are really very tense. And sometimes it isn't something even that physiologic. So in other words, a number of different sorts of events that can be affecting one thing after another are ignored in this risk factor medicine model, because it really just gets reduced down. It's reductionist. It gets reduced to a single thing. Well, your blood pressure is 145 over 90, so you need medication. And it may be that sometimes when you have somebody measure their blood pressure at different times during the day, that it isn't 145 over 90 all the time. It drops down to 120 over 80 or
right.
even lower during the day. So there's something about not looking at the origination or etiology of what's causing these events to occur.
Well, that's an interesting issue. There's a phenomenon that you know of called white coat.
White coat syndrome.
White coat syndrome, which is you go to the doctor's office and you're tense and you're stressed out and they take your blood pressure and it's high. And reading the literature on how one should actually take blood pressure, there is a very methodical way to test whether what you're seeing in high blood pressure is white coat effect, or whether it's whether there is something else going on, aside from the issue of what actually counts as high blood pressure. When should you start being worried?
Well, that brings up the issue of who sets the standards and how they get set. And I think we both remember an interview that I did with lipid researcher Dr. Mary Enig, where she was talking about, because she's an insider, she's an industry insider, she knew that when the cholesterol levels were lowered to no higher than 200, that the reason for that was because they understood that middle-aged people, people from 45 on, 50s and stuff, would have a normal blood cholesterol of about 149 or 140 or something like that. But they felt that nobody would pay attention. It's like that business of if the speed limit on the freeway is 65, then people drive 75. So you don't want to make the speed limit 75 because they'll drive 85. So in the same way, they decided to lower it to 200 so people would be more compliant, so they'd be more worried and they'd take medication sooner. But what happens now is that it's just the standard of care. But it was a manipulation. It was the drug companies having an effect on how standards are set. Do you want to talk about any of that?
Oh, you bet. I think that what you've described, even charitably, is very consistent with this phenomenon that prevention institutionally is delivered through medical care, so that even public health agencies, however well-intentioned, view the setting of standards as a way of getting people into the clinic so that they can be treated, so that disease states will be prevented. That there's other stuff going on, and that is more suspicious, but that's how it fits in institutionally with what's happening. And recently, there are things like lowering of the cholesterol limits, lowering of high blood pressure limits, and lowering of glucose tolerance limits, all of which are intended to uncharitably turn people into patients and get them on appropriate treatment, which means drugs, to prevent development of those chronic diseases.
So who is it that's setting the standards?
Generally, the way standards are set is through either professional organizations or government agencies. The cholesterol and blood pressure standards were set through the imprimatur of the National Institutes of Health, two subdivisions of them that deal with such things. But the way that they were set was rather interesting. How these things get set is to set up an expert panel. The expert panel is selected by the agency. For instance, the National Cholesterol Education Program sets the cholesterol standards. And according to government regulations, all the meetings are supposed to be open to the public and subject to criticism. The way these things proceeded was they essentially operated as private agencies. There was no public input. There was no public review. And essentially, they were presented almost as if they were government guidelines. But when the government agency, the Cholesterol Education Project, was contacted about how to give feedback on these standards, they said, well, they weren't really official government standards, they came from this other body. And of course, the panel of experts, even though they are called, even though it's based on evidence-based, so-called evidence-based medicine, is a collection of experts selected by the existing experts. So there's kind of a self-perpetuating process going on here, with that psychology of, in order to get people into treatment, we have to lower the standard. And most of the people on the expert panel are heavily implicated in, you know, the people who are doing the research, and where's the research come from? It comes from funding by drug companies.
Yeah, why am I not surprised? You're listening to a show about risk factor medicine with myself, Lena Berman, and Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD. We're discussing this concept that instead of disease prevention, you know, the old-fashioned disease prevention idea of stop drinking three bottles of wine at night and take a walk once in a while and you know, eat good foods, sort of, and exercise, is switched now to keep your parameters in terms of how you test with your various, with blood tests of various sorts that check your, you know, your blood levels of cholesterol and how is your blood pressure and stuff, that this becomes not only the new prevention is to keep these numbers at a certain standard that's set, but also to treat these as if they are illnesses. And since, as we just said, these standards keep getting lowered, for compliance, people end up on medications most of their lives. Now, one of the things that's tricky about this in terms of what this means for patients is that I think that most people have been trained, as you were talking about this culture of experts, most people have been trained to view a doctor as an expert. And you and I often talk about maybe switching that view of thinking of a doctor as an expert and switching it to a resource, so that maybe you can use a doctor as a diagnostician and you can review your choices before you move into treatment or not treatment, or you use some of the old-fashioned ways of treating yourself, the old-fashioned prevention, which was walking briskly and, you know, drinking lots of water and getting, you know, which we'll go over, you know, taking your vitamins, and that now people can make choices about what form of prevention or form of treatment they want to take. The only time this becomes a problem, in my observation, is that when people are on individual insurance plans and they get a diagnosis. So they go into their doctor's office, they have a physical, and the doctor says, you know, your cholesterol is up around 245, and I don't like it, and I think I notice that your blood pressure is 130 over 85, and it's getting a little, so I'd like you to take this drug. And you say, you know, I want to try doing this another way, and then your insurance policy gets more expensive, and you go searching for another insurance policy. You apply for a cheaper insurance. It shows on your records when they call for your records from your other doctor that you refuse treatment for hypertension and high cholesterol, and they turn you down. So I don't want to spend the whole rest of the show talking about health insurance, but one thing that you said is that you felt that that shouldn't be a deterrent from people to turn away from using other forms of treatment and prevention, that in fact, if it really comes down to it, people can still seek out group insurances through various organizations and things. If you're, you know, there are professional organizations and there are groups you can join that will have insurance policies.
Well, in the context of insurance, the dismal state of health insurance generally, that's right. The condition of individual health insurance is a smaller part of the entire health insurance picture, that most people are covered by group plans. But group plans can be through various kinds of professional or work associations. It just means that if you do have individual health coverage, you have to be careful about what goes into your chart and what you get tested for. And you are empowered to not have tests be done. The doctor wants to test your cholesterol, you can decline to do
so.
Yeah,
up to a point. What I've noticed, though, is that if you decline too many things, they only if you try to move to another insurance. I mean, I had my own experience of having had mammograms in the past and having had one 2 years ago and now deciding not to do any more. This is personal. I'm not telling other people on the air what to do. But based on what I know about mammograms and the research and the incidence of cancer that are found with mammograms. You know, anyway, everyone has to make their own decision, but I declined having another one, and when I tried to move to a cheaper insurance policy, they turned me down because of my not being willing to do this, even though there's no history in my family of this. But anyway, the point is that people are compelled or frightened or pressured into treatment a lot, and one of the reasons is insurance. Another reason, or getting a diagnosis. Something to remember is that increasingly organizations are making testing available to individuals who pay out of pocket for tests. There are groups like Life Extension, which is lef.org on the web. I have no connection to them, but I note the last time I was looking that they now will allow you to order your own blood tests for certain parameters like cholesterol and things like this. So you can sometimes do these tests without getting a doctor's order and getting it into your chart. So there are ways around some of this. But moving on from that, it occurs to me that if we make an appeal to people to kind of take on the responsibility of monitoring their own health care and prevention and monitoring their risks, not ignoring risks. I'm not telling people not to pay attention to these things. I'm telling you to review the material and think about how you want to take care of these things and whether or not the standards that are out there right now conform with what might be seen in the general population in terms of health. So what this now gets us to is what kind of resources do people need? I mean, obviously what we do is we educate. We're health educators. So that's one step, is that you try to learn as much as you can, but there's emotional resources. You need support for what you're doing, and you need to do some planning. So did you have some, as we get close to needing to take a break, do you have some?
Well, let me do a real fast take at a high level. Doctors operate from a certain kind of script, and patients do too. And patients operate and doctors operate from a script that was develop from this risk factor medicine promotion that comes out of this whole conception. So kind of the first step is to step back and pay attention to what script you're operating from, because the doctor has a certain conception of what you're supposed to do, which doesn't necessarily mean that that's what you have to do. So educational resources, if you want some specific ones, for there are two websites that I like a lot. One is for the International Network of Cholesterol Skeptics. And
what's the website?
The website is thincs.org. Another website that I like a lot is Red Flags, and its website is redflagsdaily.com.
So can we post all these on our website on
yes.
the homepage? Okay.
Yes. And of course the other resource is the recordings of these shows, which you can even use as a list to reference to other sites and other resources.
Well, because there are all the guests on our website, on our list of past shows, you'll see links to other, you know, other people with their research and whatnot too. So,
the issue of emotional support, call it psychological emotional support, is really about how you manage change, if that's what you decide to do, making decisions and managing change. You know, how do you stop smoking? How do you give up starchy foods? Those things have emotional, those are emotionally challenging changes. There was an article in issue number 5 of the Progressive Health Observer called Move to Move, which was about exercise, but covers those kinds of issues. And it's derived from, there's a book called Changing for Good by James Prochaska, Prochaska, which is about that issue of how do you emotionally make it in changing habits. And in terms of planning, in terms of planning, it's just a matter of being clear about what you want. What is it you want to accomplish? What can you accomplish? And how do you know when when something doesn't work? When the when your education, the information you have, isn't working? When the emotional support you have isn't working? When the strategy that you're following isn't working?
Okay, so we'll pick that up when we come back from break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman in studio with Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD. We're talking about risk factor medicine, and we're contrasting preventative medicine from the standpoint of looking at the entire system and what is the body trying to tell us, what is it that it needs versus suppressing symptoms based on a standard of care. We're going to take a brief 30 to 60 minute musical break, and we'll be right back with you, so stay with us. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I'm here in studio with Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, who is a health strategies advisor. He's also a political economist, and he co-produces this program with me, and also, as I said, is the backbone of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. So if you need to reach us, either of us, or if you want more information about any of the shows that we do or want to get a copy of any of the shows in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, our website is yourownhealthandfitness.com. And as Jeffrey pointed out, there's also information on the Progressive Health Observer, including individual articles that can be resourced, and all of the everything that's there will also give you the what we refer back to, the references that were used, so you'll get other information that you can sort of keep bridging one thing to another to keep studying and reading. The other thing is that Dr. Fawcett's editorials are also on our website, and they're free downloads. So yourownhealthandfitness.com, or if you want to call, my information number, it's 707-874-2772, and Dr. Fawcett is 707-874-1496. So what we just stopped with before break was this this issue of how to sort of sort through making a decision to take responsibility for yourself, and what that might mean, and how to plan, and how to think, and how to make these decisions, and how do you know when something's working? So that's a good place to pick up. This is one of those questions. You know, when I used to work with people with exercise, people would sometimes tell me that they were doing this kind of exercise approach, but they weren't seeing any results, and I'd say, well, it's not working. You know, if you're doing something that's working for your body, you see results. They may not be fast, but you see them. So why don't you tell us what you think, how you review that?
When I work with people, one of the first things I ask them is, what do you want to accomplish? And in this context, the question is maybe more focused to, how much self-care do you want to take responsibility for? So all of the resources that I've pointed to are places for people to start. Part of what's going on here is, as I said before the break, is rethinking what script you want to operate from when you're dealing with health issues and with the medical system as such. Are you going to play how much of the role that they want you to play are you going to play, and how much do you do for yourself outside of that system?
Well, you know what I think would be helpful for people, if we can spend the rest of the time doing this, is to kind of give people some concrete examples of how this thinking works.
Sure.
So one thing that I said at the frame of the show is, instead of risk factors, it might be worth looking at disruptions in biology and seeing what they mean. And as I've talked about on the show quite a bit, biology responds, and you've said this too, responds to the environment, and the environment may contain stress in the form of toxins and germs and emotional stress, things that you take in from your external environment, but you also take food in and nutrients. So that may be some of the places where you will see disruptions causing some kind of symptom. So we made a kind of loose list of examples of biological disruptions and symptoms that are becoming diseases. You know, the big one would be any cardiovascular symptoms, and that would include an angina or even pulmonary effects and symptoms, including cholesterol levels being high, triglyceride levels being high, hypertension. There are things that are now being called metabolic syndrome or prediabetes. Hormone imbalances, I think, fall under this category, where somebody has a symptom like a chronic vaginitis, for instance, in a woman, and maybe she's not having periods, and instead of like unwinding this, they immediately put her on a birth control pill, for instance. Obesity is a potential symptom of metabolic disruption. Allergies and asthma, certainly, an immune disruption. Depression and depression often is accompanied by insomnia are also symptoms of some kind of biological disruption. So why don't we unpack some of these? Do you have a place you want to start? I just have this list with notes written all over it, and I'm sure you have your own notes.
Let me start with metabolic syndrome.
Yeah, it's kind of your favorite.
Well, it's the recent favorite because I just got through writing an article for the latest issue about metabolic syndrome. In the context of much of what we've been discussing today, the idea of metabolic syndrome actually came from this connection of seemingly disparate things that Gerald Reven, professor of medicine at Stanford University, discovered a relationship between middle-aged people with insulin resistance and risk of heart disease, risk of heart attack. What that has developed into is an odd kind of diagnosis that is in the spirit of the risk factor approach, but has been reduced to a set of criteria that if you pass or fail, you get a disease. You get designated as having a disease. Now, the idea of metabolic syndrome is that if you look at lipid metabolism, fat metabolism, triglycerides, insulin resistance, blood pressure, and body fat, some combination of those, if certain standards are exceeded, puts you in the category as having metabolic syndrome, which puts you at greater risk of having heart disease. And the thing about those particular standards is each of the criteria is subclinical. That is, for instance, the insulin resistance criteria will not get you diagnosed with diabetes, maybe with prediabetes, but not with diabetes. Blood pressure won't get you diagnosed with hypertension, etc. So there's this thinking that here's this endocrinological system that is involved in insulin resistance and energy metabolism generally, that affects your vascular system. And so, to me, the logical step is to unwrap what's going on with those systems, what's causing those systems to be disrupted. What happens in the medical context is you are simply treated with the pharmaceuticals assigned to treating blood sugar disruptions or irregularities and lipid irregularities and blood pressure irregularities. And one of the interesting things that that emerges from these the study of metabolic syndrome is that regardless of the criteria that that someone has, the people who are physically more active or have higher levels of in the literature is called cardiorespiratory fitness, have pretty much a disappearance of risk of developing heart disease, kidney disease, diabetes, all the things that would be a consequence of metabolic syndrome.
Let me stop you. I want to be really clear about what you just said. What you're saying is there's a confluence of symptoms. Insulin resistance would be where people's blood sugars are not staying stable and they have signs of really high insulin levels. So they're having blood sugar crashes and hypoglycemia, and they've got a lot of weight gain in the waist and skinny arms and legs. And in women, their periods are irregular and they're having all kinds of disruptions. And their blood pressure is creeping up and their triglycerides are getting really high, you know, like certainly above 100 and maybe even up around 200, 300. And what you're saying is that all the literature supports the use of exercise and movement of various sorts to reverse these symptoms.
Yes. Well, it's not all the literature. There's pretty much a limited amount of literature that actually looks at physical activity as a risk factor in evaluating the risks associated with metabolic syndrome. But even that's just one example, because another aspect of the metabolic syndrome is this whole notion that the name itself says it. There's something going on in the metabolism that's disrupting the energy metabolism that affects the triglycerides, lipids, blood sugars, and blood pressure, and with it, body weight, body fat.
Distribution
of body fat. Yeah. So those are all symptoms that are pointing to something else that's going on, so that but instead of looking for that, unraveling all of that, as that approach, the very approach itself suggests, it simply gets treated with the standard treatments for those conditions, for the lipids, etc.
You know, what's interesting about looking at metabolic syndrome, too, as a series of different risk factors, as
yes.
we're talking about them, is that one thing is that you think to yourself, well, where is this coming from? And there's research to support the idea that, gosh, you know, there's so many things now, that pollution and dioxins and metal, that there are all these pollution things that could be causing disruption like this. We just heard from Ernest Sternglass, who talked about the effects of radiation and how ubiquitous radiation exposure is on our planet now, and how much that damages all these pathways that are supposed to work a certain way. And then, of course, Dr. Richard Cunyon has been talking a lot on the air about methylation. And when I talked to him last time, I could hear the lights going off in his head when I talked about Sternglass and the idea that methylation, this gets interrupted. These are pathways that lead to detoxification that get interrupted somewhere along the line by nutrient deficiency. And we see these DNA mutations where people don't aren't able to move through these detoxification pathways to get to the end result of detoxing, instead get stuck in some place along the way that causes a rise of things like homocysteine, which causes clotting and heart disease, that we see these people who have a problem in these pathways. And I could see Richard Cunyon was thinking, wow, well, maybe one of the reasons for this happening is related to the radiation exposure. Maybe that's, but in a way, there's a point where it doesn't really even matter that far back where it comes from. What matters is if we can identify that someone has a folic acid deficiency, even by their symptoms or by testing them for a mutation, where they're not able to utilize folic acid, and they're low in folic acid, and they're low in B12, and they need B6, and they need a little bit of extra K to kind of boost up this methylation pathway. So it's B12, high folic acid. When you raise those two, you raise up K a little bit. And B6 is often a player in this as well. So this goes back to Kilmer McCulley's research about homocysteine that got him fired from Harvard, was it? I think Harvard. One of the big schools. As a cause of heart disease. So what we're saying is that there are so many different ways in which the body can become disrupted. And although it's useful to look at somebody's health history to see whether there's enough in the family line, is there early heart disease? Do you see people having heart disease early? Right. Well, then maybe it is worthwhile checking to see which clotting factor, which heart disease factor are they at risk for? Or is it just as well to get them moving, to get their diet changed so that their blood sugar is stabilized without the use of a drug, and then to add in some of these nutrients that help these detox pathways to get moving again. It's an interesting, there's a way in which this all sort of comes down to one thing, which is, you know, to do what your grandmother, if she was a nice person, was telling you to do.
Well, in addition to that, there's a whole other nutrient-based piece of this, which has to do with the antioxidants and the oxidative load. Much of the many of these conditions are really dependent on
they're inflammatory.
They're inflammatory. Yeah. For instance, one paper I've read on heart disease proposes that heart and heart disease means literally that. It doesn't mean coronary artery disease. It's not about hardening of the arteries. It's about the heart muscle itself failing. Occurs, can be effectively treated with CoQ10 just because of the metabolism of the heart.
Well, CoQ10 is more than an antioxidant. It actually has other effects that protect the heart muscle, along with carnitine, which is another nutrient that protects the heart.
But the way that protects it is as an antioxidant effect, because the mitochondria, in producing ATP, is an oxidative process. It creates effectively free radicals that has to be cleaned up, and your body produces CoQ10 to do that. And when you take statins, it destroys your capacity to produce CoQ10.
Or to utilize carnitine. Yeah,
yes.
Those two. Well, it's a muscle. The heart is a big muscle, and it needs what we just said to unpack it quickly. Let me just say, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in studio with Jeffrey Fawcett, PhD, and we're talking about risk factor medicine, and we're trying to give people some alternatives to doing just, your cholesterol's this, and so we have to give you this. It's impossible to be a carbon-based being and to use oxygen as you know, for your energy cycle and not have oxidative stress. The question is, your body is designed to handle a certain amount of oxidative stress. And when you start loading it on with some of these other issues that we just mentioned, stress, nutrient deficiencies, either caused by DNA mutations interrupting your ability to use nutrients, or because your diet is crummy and you don't have access to good foods, or you don't know any better, stress and pollution. Pollution is stress. Also, toxins and germs that cause inflammation increase all of this oxidative damage. So all of this nonsense that you see in the media about antioxidants being pro-oxidative are occurring when they use a single antioxidant in a very low dose, usually a synthetic form, and they don't give any other vitamins and antioxidants in the same individual. The reason is because these antioxidants are donating their electrons to damaged molecules, and if they don't get repleted themselves by dosing yourself with vitamin C three times a day because it gets used up, and having a whole melange of these other antioxidants together.
Antioxidants work together. For example, vitamin C, not only itself is an antioxidant, it recharges vitamin E, which is the single most important fat-soluble antioxidant, because it's able to move along cell membranes and in LDL particles and clean things up. It's implicated in helping to prevent oxidative damage to LDL, which is implicated in the genesis of arteriosclerosis.
So just to go back briefly, if we're looking at metabolic syndrome, we may also be looking at cardiovascular symptoms.
Yes.
So you're going to be seeing hypertension. You're going to see possibly, as a byproduct, again, smoke, not fire, blood sugar abnormalities, some heart symptoms, lipid things like triglycerides being high. And what we're saying is exercise, obviously eating a diet that is not provocative in terms of blood sugar, so keeping your blood sugar stable, which will also lower your triglycerides, adding in heart protective nutrients, because we see these interfered with in people who have metabolic syndrome. So the folate, folic acid, all of the B vitamins, particularly B12, vitamin K, if you're raising your folic acid up, vitamin C6, all these B vitamins, very protective. Some people benefit from the use of betaine, which is trimethylglycine. Now, this is a pretty strong player, and I found that men tend to need it more than women, but you can also boost your levels of betaine by actually eating some beets and some spinach, so you can get it from your diet as well. And making sure that you've got, if you've got histories of heart disease in your family, carnitine and CoQ10, and I'm talking about in addition to a good vitamin and mineral program, and the essential fatty acids are anti-inflammatory. Either your flax or your hemp seed omega-3 fats, and your good ratio between those omega-3s and your omega-6 fats that you're getting from vegetables, and not damaging your fats, which causes oxidative stress as well. Now, moving on, we've got like hypertension, and I have to tell you that for me, a lot of what I see in my practice is either that there's biological disruptions that are causing all of this to start, and then you have to interrupt it by adding back in the proper nutrients and to getting the detox pathways to work, but also stress. So in other words, hypertension goes along with metabolic syndrome, but you've also got stress that has to be controlled, and that can be controlled to some degree through exercise and whatnot. But sometimes it's useful for people to actually get a blood pressure cuff and look at how their mood affects their blood pressure. Hormone imbalances, particularly low thyroid, is a big problem with hypertension. People whose thyroid is low often have hypertension because their cortisol, their stress levels get too high. And then there are the nutrients, all the ones I mentioned, including magnesium, which is a vasodilator, so taken at night, it will help to open the pathways. People take a lot of calcium without taking magnesium, potassium to balance sodium, and exercise. Obesity, again, we're going to be doing a show on obesity in a few weeks, may be a symptom of some disruption. Hormone imbalances, you've heard me talk about endlessly on the show, and you can always go back and look at some of the work we've done on hormones, but when testosterone gets low in men or women, it causes more heart problems, more sticky blood, imbalances between estrogen and progesterone, where the estrogen is too high and the progesterone is too low. People have more clotting, and women with hysterectomies almost always need testosterone. So hormone balances are very much a part of this whole picture. And then allergies and autoimmune, interestingly enough, are not only from just too much stuff. You know, the immune system just can't handle any more pollution. It can't handle eating certain foods. There's too much food allergies. There's concomitant allergies between grains, eating a lot of grains and breathing in pollens. But there's also a problem with allergies and trans fats. So no kidding, no trans fats. That doesn't mean you can't have saturated fats, because trans fats being solid doesn't make them the same as saturated fats. And lastly, depression is also folded back on cardiovascular disease. There's all kinds of, you know, these are all symptoms of something else. So the whole picture of taking your vitamins, eating foods that don't encourage a high blood sugar response in you, and you all know what that is, it's less of an issue having your weight down so that you look like somebody on television or in the newspaper or in the magazines or something, and more important that you are active at whatever weight you are and that your distribution of fat doesn't favor your gut. You're not walking around with a huge gut and skinny arms and legs, because that's going to be a bad moment. There's no way to get around it. I mean, getting enough rest, maintaining some level of healthy stress management, vitamin supplementation, depression has its own series. Methylation here is also very important. So the B12 and the B6 and the folic acid often, and the hormones fold back into the depression. So I'm doing that thing I do of saying 6 million things at once. We're running out of time. Do you want to add anything in here? Do you dare?
Do I dare? Well, I just wanted to mention that regarding obesity, that, again, this last issue of the newsletter has an article about obesity in it. Certainly one of the most important things about obesity is just how it is framed. Obesity is framed as really it is just being overweight is now part of obesity. There's a big hue and cry about obesity being a disease. In fact, there's been a lot of work about obesity, which what they really mean is excess weight, body fat, as being a disease. And there's plenty of evidence that where the dangers are at the extremes of body weight, but there is a comfortable middle. So the real question is, and again, it is physical activity that attenuates the effect of excess body fat.
It changes the way your body understands nutrients,
yes,
too. It uses them differently. So we're just about out of time. So I guess we will have to stop here, leave it here. So I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. And you've been listening to a show with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. If you want to get hold of Dr. Fawcett, his number is 707-874-1496, where you can go to the website and go to About Us. If you need more information or want a cassette copy of this or any other show in the series, again, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.com. You can also call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows or information about your guests or any information that will get you links to guests, again, go to the website. There's also information there on subscribing to the newsletter Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness, 8.5x11 Productions, and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Vinnie Beecham. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.